Hello, folks. Thank you for tuning into the Federalist Files. We're getting to Federalist number 81 today. It is titled The Judiciary Continued and the Distribution of the Judicial Authority. It's written by Alexander Hamilton, June 25th, 1788. Topics include the defense of the judicial power, argument that the judiciary will supersede the legislature. Judiciary must be independent. Judges liable to impeachment as a security federal court apparatus. The federal court apparatus part is kind of, it's pretty, not vague, but it's very general. In terms of a judiciary, it's probably the most broad branch in the federal government, because in terms of a federal judiciary, that's up to the Congress or the legislature. So this paper describes the partition of judiciary authority between different courts and their relations. It starts off, and I quote, "The judicial power of the United States is to be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress from time to time ordain and establish." That's directly from the Constitution. So yes, the Supreme Court's set in stone. That's the only thing in the judiciary that's set in stone. Now, the particulars, the specifics, how many court justices there are to be, that's not set in stone in the Constitution. Like I said, it's very broad. But inferior courts, as in appellate courts, appealing courts, they shall be established and ordained from time to time from the Congress. So Hamilton claims that this provision is to be little contested and has been explained in a multitude of forms in preceding papers. The only distinction that has been raised for concern is whether the Supreme Court ought to be its own distinct body or a branch of the legislative authority, which would be a serious problem if you had, because in other countries, in other republics, you had the Congress itself was the judicial authority. That's how it was in the Articles of Confederation as well, in terms of a federal judiciary. So, the argument that this charge is founded upon is described, and I quote, "The authority of the proposed Supreme Court of the United States, which is to be a separate and independent body, will be superior to that of the legislature. The power of construing the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution will enable that court to mold them into whatever shape it may think proper, especially as its decisions will not be in any manner subject to the revision or correction of the legislative body," end quote. See, it's kind of interesting. So, in terms of the construing of laws, the construing of the Constitution, that is the job of the Supreme Court. But the legislative body has the power to create these inferior courts and lay out some of the groundwork for that. And what's going on right now is the dissenters are saying the Supreme Court has all the power to do all of these things, and that's just not the case. They're purposely confounding it in the Constitution because they objected to the Constitution, so they were kind of just grabbing at a straw here. They were just lying, making it up. Hamilton believed that this was a misconceived fact based on false reasoning. So he states next, and I quote, "In the first place, there is not a syllable in the plan under consideration which directly empowers the national courts to construe the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution, or which gives them any greater latitude in this respect than may be claimed by the courts of every state. I admit, however, that the Constitution ought to be the standard of construction for the laws, and that wherever there is an evident opposition, the laws ought to give place to the Constitution. There can be no objection, therefore, on this account, to the federal judicature, which will not lie against the local judicatures in general, and which will not serve to condemn every constitution that attempts to set bounds to legislative discretion," end quote. So yes, the other thing that they're worried about is that the judiciary would become a super legislative branch, because they would be able to be the ones that would prescribe the laws or interpret the laws and interpret them a certain way, which is actually a pretty good, if you look in modern day times, it's a pretty solid argument. It seems like the Supreme Court at certain times has actually worked as a super legislature for the Democrat Party when they can't get things passed through. So this really isn't that false of a premise here. The only problem is that there is actually a safeguard against this, and it's called impeachment. And I think he kind of somewhat goes over that as well here. "So contenders of the Constitution argue that the Supreme Court, because of their position, will be able to write law and supersede the will of the legislature. and will not be subject to the revision or correction of the legislative body. And that's something that he actually mentions. He is correct. I mean, the dissenters in a way are correct because in modern day times, the Supreme Court can work as a federal super legislature, but there is a safeguard against this written into the Constitution. It's just not used. It's not actively used like it should be used by the federal representatives. And the reason they aren't used is because a lot of them are tyrants and a lot of them like gun control. A lot of them like these different court decisions that conflict directly with the Constitution. So Hamilton, he contends that the Supreme Court doesn't have a specific provision that empowers them to do so, as in empowers them to actually physically write law. Although Hamilton does admit, and I'm quoting here, "The Constitution ought to be the standard of construction for the laws, and that wherever there is an evident opposition, the laws ought to give place to the Constitution." End quote. So yes, what he's saying is in a perfect, and he's trying to, I mean, man is obviously fallible, but he's trying to say in a perfect world where you have people that are supposed to interpret the Constitution, every single law in the United States, if it conflicts with the Constitution, it is an invalid law. The deference is always to the Constitution, and that's really what he's saying here. And he's saying because of that deference going to the Constitution, it can't be possible for a Supreme Court justice, if they really do believe in the Constitution, to become some sort of super legislature. In other words, all law should be furnished from the Constitution, and when contentious laws are proclaimed, those laws should be overpowered by the Constitution, which he's right. So, next he states, and I quote, "The same spirit which had operated in making them would be too apt in interpreting them. Still less could it be expected that men who had infringed the Constitution in the character of legislators would be disposed to repair the breach in the character of judges. Nor is this all. Every reason which recommends the tenure of good behavior for judicial offices militates against placing the judiciary power in the last resort in a body composed of men chosen for a limited period." End quote. So he's saying this is why they have their tenure on good behavior, is because you can't trust the legislative body, because the legislative body, if they're the ones passing the law, they're writing the law and passing it, how are you going to also trust them as well to interpret the law and say this is valid? Because they can pass any tyrannical policy that they want. Now, Man, this is the most perfect governing document of all time. Okay, we do have some sort of problems with the super legislature in the Supreme Court. And in other courts, other inferior courts as well. But that's not because of the plan. That's not because of the Constitution. That's because man is fallible and man screws everything up. It has nothing to do with the Constitution. It's written perfectly in this case. It's just that you don't have judges that are actually beholden to the Constitution and beholden to liberty and freedom for all, unfortunately. We've seen the Supreme Court screw up many times. I'm pretty sure they upheld, I'm trying to think if it, I know a lot of racist or segregationist laws they upheld for a while back in the 1900s and 1950s, 60s. So, I mean, the Supreme Court always has not been perfect because, once again, like I said, all men are fallible. So, next, Hamilton makes the case that the Supreme Court cannot have a disposition in the legislative body. He states, and I quote, "From a body which had even a partial agency in passing bad laws, we could rarely expect a disposition to temper and moderate them in the application. The same spirit which had operated in making them would be too apt in interpreting them." Just as I said before, you cannot have the people making and writing the laws, then interpreting the laws and saying, oh, these are valid, these are fine. So Hamilton, he argues that if the legislature had a hand in the judiciary decisions, that they would be less likely to repair the breach in the character of judges and would hold bias towards interpreting the laws that they themselves already have passed. The inflammations of party animus would poison the water, and the legislature would lack the necessary knowledge to carry through with the responsibilities of the Supreme Court. Hamilton next asserts, and I quote, "There is still greater absurdity in subjecting the decisions of men selected for their knowledge of the laws acquired by long and laborious study to the revision and control of men who, for want of the same advantage, cannot be deficient in that knowledge," end quote. So yeah, you can't have the legislative authority subjecting, it is ridiculous. You can't have the legislative authority taking control of a judiciary branch when they really don't have any profession. I mean, nowadays, the Senate has a lot of lawyers. I think Elizabeth Warren was a lawyer, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, there's a lot of lawyers. I think even Mike Lee. But you can't have a bunch of people that work in the legislative body, people like, let's say, AOC, tell the judiciary how to read laws like they know better than them, which is correct, obviously. You can't have all that power laid in one branch of government in the legislative body, because then you're going to have some problems. All you got to get is a tyrannical few that infect the entire lot of them, and now they're the people that are passing the law and then interpreting the law and then signing off on it. So Hamilton, next. He explains, and I quote, "A legislature, without exceeding its province, cannot reverse a determination once made in a particular case, though it may prescribe a new rule for future cases," end quote. So this is very interesting, and this is human nature. He's saying, once you have someone in the legislature, and this is true, government has continued over time for the last 250 years in the United States, has only gotten larger, more powerful, and more tyrannical, and more despotic in their behavior. It has not receded. The power of government has only improved. It has not receded in any way, in really any facet that I can even think of. If anybody knows of any, you can email me. But and that's really what he's saying. When you have the legislative body come through with some sort of determination in a particular case, it's not going to have it. It'll have new rules to extend its power. It's not going to recede any of its power in the government in a general sense. So Hamilton notes that because of this, the legislature will never retain extensive amounts of misconstructions and contraventions. He states, and I quote, "This may be inferred with certainty from the general nature of the judicial power, from the objects to which it relates, from the manner in which it is exercised, from its comparative weakness, and from its total incapacity to support its usurpations by force," end quote. So that's another thing. You had all of these people that were so worried about a usurpation from the judicial branch, but guess what, folks? The judicial branch has no actual authority. It can say this is how the law is and this is how it is laid out, let's say. How are they going to enforce it? They need the executive branch. How are they going to get the funding to enforce it? They need the legislative branch. So the judiciary really is, it's weird because it's almost like a Trojan horse in some cases. It's a big underdog because it can become a super legislature. But other than that, enforcing the laws or enforcing some sort of new case law decision by the Supreme Court, they really can't do it. They don't have the power to do it. They would need the executive authority to enforce the law, and then they would need the legislative branch in order to call upon the troops or provide the funding to enforce that tyrannical law. So, for this reason, the judiciary can never overpower that of the legislature. Additionally, the legislative body has the power to impeach those members of the judicial department, Hamilton adds, and I quote, "And the inference is greatly fortified by the consideration of the important constitutional check which the power of instituting impeachments in one part of the legislative body and of determining upon them in the other would give to that body upon the members of the judicial department. This is alone a complete security." End quote. Yeah, so that's a complete security against usurpations from the judiciary. You have an impeachment authority in the legislative body. They can impeach these Supreme Court justices really at will. There's no specific. There's really it's a political action. There's no specific laid out terms of service in which you can go forward with an impeachment of a Supreme Court member or anybody in the judiciary. Supreme Court wise, there's only been one attempt at an impeachment. The articles went through the House and then they were shot down in the Senate. So it's never actually a person fully impeached in the Supreme Court has never happened. Now, this ought to serve as an example for solidifying the argument of the power of the Senate to work as a court in the trial of impeachments, of course. So next, Hamilton, he examines the organizational apparatus of the federal judiciary. He calls for federal courts in each state or district and the power of the federal judiciary to establish them. So Hamilton states, and I quote, "The power of constituting inferior courts is evidently calculated to obviate the necessity of having recourse to the Supreme Court in every case of federal cognizance. It is intended to enable the national government to institute or authorize in each state or district of the United States a tribunal competent to the determination of matters of national jurisdiction within its limits." Okay, end quote. So I did say earlier, it's not the power of the judiciary. I just said that before this quote. It's the power of the legislative authority to do so, or the United States, or the Union. Just wanted to fix that. So, yes, the point of having these appeal courts and having these subordinate courts to the Supreme Court, you don't want every single case to go up to the Supreme Court that is in conflict or has the jurisdiction of the union written all over it. Jurisdiction of the union in court cases, it would be anything that conflicts with the Constitution. Additionally, it would also be anything having to do with foreign nations or interstate conflict. You know, New Jersey and New York, you would have to have a Supreme Court or a federal court deal with that. And that's the point, is you don't want every single individual crisis, every single situation or instance go straight to the Supreme Court, because then it would be an influx of cases that they wouldn't be able to handle. So that's the reason why you lay that power in the legislative authority to institute and authorize state and district courts. So we have district courts of appeals in the United States. Right now, that's what we currently have. Now, Hamilton contends that state courts are disqualified from holding this power because of the prevalence of local spirit and lack of necessary knowledge. So that's the power of seeing some of these union cases, things that are related to the federal judiciary, specifically in the Constitution, which we went over last Federalist paper. So he states next, and I quote, "Though the fitness and competency of those courts should be allowed in the utmost latitude, yet the substance of the power in question may still be regarded as a necessary part of the plan, if it were only to empower the national legislature to commit to them the cognizance of causes arising out of the national constitution, to confer the power of determining such causes upon the existing courts of the several states would perhaps be as much to constitute tribunals as to create new courts with the like power," end quote. Yeah, so we're talking about specifically instances of interstate conflict, foreign conflict, things that specifically conflict with the Constitution. We're talking about those instances. You cannot have that taken by a state court. Now, in cases of, or maritime and admiralty, in cases of things that conflict with the Constitution, you may see that in a state court at a superior court level, and then it will eventually appeal up to a federal district court, and then it will go to the Supreme Court if it needs to be appealed all the way up to that level. That's generally how the court system works. But in terms of foreign nations, admiralty, maritime operations, and interstate conflict where one state is suing the other, that specifically will be seen in a federal district court, and then eventually will be appealed up to the Supreme Court if it's not able to be rectified on that more local level. So yes, what he's saying is those state courts aren't going to be able to handle those issues. That'll be specifically federal district courts. So next he states, and I quote, "There are, in my opinion, substantial reasons against such a provision. The most discerning cannot foresee how far the prevalency of a local spirit may be found to disqualify the local tribunals for the jurisdictions of national causes. Whilst every man may discover that courts constituted like those of some of the states would be improper channels of the judicial authority of the union. State judges hold their offices during pleasure or from year to year, will be too little independent to be relied upon for an inflexible execution of the national laws," end quote. So yes, all judges of the federal district court, whether it's the federal district court, as long as you are federal judge or it's the Supreme Court, you are to hold your term on good standing, a good behavior. It's a life term until you decide to step down or you do something bad and you get impeached, okay? So, because of that now, that cannot be done in the state. We can't have the state court handling federal district courts in a general, like, you can't have the legislative authority in the state of New Jersey, even though, let's say, the 8th District Court is in New Jersey. You can't have the state legislature handle and have those rules in that district court. You just can't have it done. That has to be federally done, so you can't have the state specifically pushing their jurisdiction on those federal courts. And that's always that he's really referring to. Hamilton, he establishes that the federal government is to have the power to employ federal district courts for expediency of appeal cases and those which are related to the Constitution. So next he states, and I quote, "I am not sure but that it will be found highly expedient and useful to divide the United States into 4 or 5 or half a dozen districts and to institute a federal court in each district in lieu of one in every state. The judges of these courts, with the aid of the state judges, may hold circuits for the trial of causes in the several parts of their respective districts. Justice through them may be administered with ease and dispatch, and appeals may be safely circumscribed within a narrow compass," end quote. So yeah, that's just really the organizational structure of things. Let's say you go up to a state court. there's some sort of Second Amendment case, you get shot down in the state court, right? Then you go for the appeal in the district court. District court does the same thing. They kind of shoot you down. Then you go for another appeal. And then the Supreme Court decides whether or not they want to take the case or push it back down to the appeal court, or they want to rule on it and say, you know, the appeal court was correct or what have you. So Hamilton, he explains that with the exception of cases, and I'm quoting here, affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, end quote, the Supreme Court will exclusively be an appeals court of the highest order. So that, once again, anything that's affecting ambassadors, public ministers, consuls, or anything in which the state is a party, that's where you go to a federal appeals court. And the reason for that would be you don't want the state government kind of pushing their influence and their local politics in a court case where the state is a party in it. As an example of a state involved case, Hamilton, he cites that if a state government were to adopt a proposed plan that contracts between the nation and individuals are to be binding upon the state governments. That being said, the enforcement of duties are to be collected by the state taxation apparatus. Thus, a contingency on the state government to collect and pay debts owed to the national government. Therefore, to enforce the Constitution, it is imperative the judicature plays a role in enforcement rather than waging a war against contracting state governments. So really what he's kind of referring to is you're going to use the state taxation apparatus in terms of, because they were doing the duties, the imports and the exports. So you had state agents that would be collecting the fees. They'd be collecting the taxation fees, and then they're supposed to push it up to the federal court, the federal jurisdiction. So in a case like that, you would have that. That's where a state would be a party. That's his example of a state being a party against the federal government. So next, Hamilton explains the Supreme Court shall work in the appellate jurisdiction in matters of civil law. This is very interesting here. He goes on to state, and I quote, "The expression taken in the abstract denotes nothing more than the power of one tribunal to review the proceedings of another, either as to law or fact or both." So he starts to talk about law and fact. The Supreme Court or the federal judiciary will have the power to review laws and facts in court cases, but they will not have the power to overturn a jury decision. They may revisit a jury decision and kind of analyze it, but they don't have the power to overturn it. They can say, we're going to draw up a whole new jury and they're going to rule on this case, or we're going to resee the case again, but they themselves cannot overturn something that a jury says, which shows that the power would be in the people, essentially, because then we would have a serious problem if the federal judiciary can decide to just overturn civil cases at will. And I think that would even go for criminal cases as well, but I'm not 100% sure. Okay, so he states, and I quote, "The re-examination of a fact once determined by a jury should in any case be admitted under the proposed Constitution. It may be so regulated as to be done by a second jury," end quote. So this is what he's saying. If you have this go to the federal court and there's a review of it, there's nothing that can really be done by judiciary except drawing upon a second jury to rule on the case. So the citizens themselves would once again rule on the case, which I think is a really ingenious and very underrepresented, very underappreciated part in our Constitution. So this ensures that the Supreme Court will not be in the business of reexamining jury decisions. So he goes on to state, and I quote, and this is kind of talking about the fact and the law thing. It's a little confusing, but I'll explain. He states, and I quote, "Though the common law courts of the state ascertain disputed facts by a jury, yet they unquestionably have jurisdiction of both fact and law, and accordingly, when the former is agreed in the pleadings, they have no recourse to a jury, but proceed at once to judgment. I contend, therefore, on this ground, that the expressions appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, do not necessarily imply a re-examination in the Supreme Court of facts decided by juries in the inferior courts," end quote. So yes, what he's saying is, in the states currently, they have kind of some screwed up systems. Specifically, what he's saying is the jury can come out with a verdict, and then some of these state courts have the jurisdiction to kind of overturn what a jury says, and there's no recourse for the jury, and they can just determine themselves, the state courts, what is fact. And he's saying the Supreme Court's not going to have power like that. They're not going to be able to re-examine some of these facts, but they can have juries that will do that for them in some of the inferior courts, and then once it gets to a Supreme Court as well. So Hamilton, he asserts next, and I quote, To avoid all inconveniences, it will be safest to declare generally that the Supreme Court shall possess appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, and that this jurisdiction shall be subject to such exceptions and regulations as the national legislature may prescribe. This will enable the government to modify it in such a manner as will best answer the ends of the public justice and security, end quote. So it's very important that he says that at the very end, as to, it will answer the ends of the public justice and security. So that just kind of infers that the federal legislative body can't just upend the entire system if they wanted to. So he goes on next, he states, and I quote, "This view of the matter at any rate puts it out of all doubt that the supposed abolition of the trial by jury by the operation of this provision is fallacious and untrue. The legislature of the United States would certainly have full power to provide that in appeals to the Supreme Court there should be no reexamination of facts where they have had already been tried in the original causes by juries. This would certainly be an authorized exception, but if, for the reason already intimated, it should be thought too extensive, it might be qualified with a limitation to such causes only as determinable at common law in that mode of trial," end quote. Yes. So yeah, there may be some cases where the Supreme Court will kind of reanalyze some of these facts, but they're not, once again, they're not going to be drawing the verdict on it. It's going to still be a jury that they would have to call upon. It is very confusing, this one especially. It's probably one of the most confusing ones I've ever read. So we have the very last quote here. I think this one's very important as well. And then we're gonna have the next one, which is kind of a little bit of this. It's going to be a little shorter than this. It's much more simple. It's talking about the relationship between the state courts and the federal courts. So he states next, and I quote, "The amount of the observations hitherto made on authority of the Judicial Department is this, that it has been carefully restricted to those causes which are manifestly proper for the cognizance of the national judicature, that in the partition of this authority, a very small portion of original jurisdiction has been preserved to the Supreme Court, and the rest consigned to the subordinate tribunals, that the Supreme Court will possess an appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, in all the cases referred to them, both subject to any exceptions and regulations which may be thought advisable, and that this appellate jurisdiction does in no case abolish the trial by jury, and that an ordinary degree of prudence and integrity in the national councils will ensure us solid advantages from the establishment of the proposed judiciary without exposing us to any inconveniences which have been predicted from that source," end quote. So yeah, it's a long one. Most importantly here, it's pretty much a summary of the entire paper. You can pull this paper off if there's a little bit of confusion. You can literally just read the last paragraph, and that's it. You don't even need to go through this in the entire paper if you're kind of confused with what I said, anything that I said today. Really, what he's saying is the Supreme Court, it can see facts and law. It can rehash those cases that came from subordinate appeals courses or subordinate state courts, but they can't rule and they can't abolish the trial by jury. They can't overturn a jury decision, and that's probably the most important part of this paper, and it does keep the federal judiciary in check. So that will conclude this one. I greatly appreciate everybody tuning in. We're going to be going over Federalist number 82 next time. It's going to be much more about the relationship and the concurrent powers of the state and federal courts. Once again, I greatly appreciate everybody tuning in. Please drop the mic, let people know about the podcast, like, share, subscribe. We're nearing the end of these papers, so very good. We only have about, what, 4 more of them left, 82, 83, 84, 85. So, yeah, greatly appreciate it, folks, and I will see you all next time.